Thank you. I want to see if anybody needs a handout or you did not get one. Put your hand up, please. Okay. Thank you, Bob, not only for your introduction, but for asking me to speak on the topic of ecclesiology. It's a real privilege and an honor to speak on a subject that's so near and dear to God's heart. And one place that God's heart toward the church is especially seen is in Paul's letter to Timothy, through whom Paul gave instructions to the church at Ephesus. God chose to preserve this letter for us in his word. So the instructions to Timothy at Ephesus is just as relevant to us today as it was to them in that day. And I want you to notice right in the middle of the letter, here's what Paul says. I write so that you may know how it is necessary, dei, to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. Please look at the last two lines, that the church is the pillar and support of the truth. And of course, there's no truth more important than the saving message of Jesus. And notice in the middle of the verse, the middle two lines, that Paul is writing to give directions or instruction on conduct in the house of God. And God has given a design for the church to make it the best pillar and support of the truth that it can be. Now notice the first two lines. I write that you may know how it is necessary to conduct yourselves. That word dei is the Greek word for necessary. It's a very strong word in the New Testament. Let me give you three examples of where it's found elsewhere in the New Testament, just to show you how strong this word is. In John 3:7, we're told, Jesus said, you must be dei, born again. John 3:14, Jesus said, the Son of Man must be dei, lifted up. In John 29, John writes that he must dei, rise again from the dead. Dei is a pretty strong word, especially when you think about it in 1 Timothy 3:15. Paul isn't giving suggestions about how a church might conduct itself. He says it is necessary. It must conduct itself this way to be the best pillar and support of the truth that it can be. One of my great privileges in life, as Bob already alluded to, was to be taught by Zane Hodges. I think the first course I took from Zane, other than baby Greek, was the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. And as was true in, I think, all of his courses, he would give us a commentary on those books, unpublished commentary, which is nothing short of gold for those of us that have that. I have it. And I'm going to share with you some of Zane's statements from that commentary today, but I want to start with this one because this is where Zane comments on the verse that I just read. Here's what he says. Ecclesiology is vitally important. The modern-day playing down of local church order is a deep assistance to the satanic attack on the pillar and support of God's truth. How important the pillar and support are can be measured by the significance of the truth it maintains. And no doubt Zane had in mind, Paul had in mind what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 1 when he said, believe, or Jesus Christ, believe on him for everlasting life. That is the ultimate truth that the church is to be a pillar and support of, to lift up in this world of darkness. I want to summarize 1 Timothy 3:15 very simply, that God designed the church to be the pillar and support of the truth. That's the bottom line for what I want to share about ecclesiology today, that God designed the church to be the pillar and support of the truth. And the more that we follow his design that he says it is necessary to follow, we will be the best pillar and support we can be. Free grace people I know are passionate about the truth of the saving message. But based on what Paul wrote to Timothy, free grace people should also be passionate about ecclesiology, the truth about the church and what the church is to be. I want to illustrate the importance of the church being the pillar and support of the truth with a conversation I had years ago with a man in our community named Claude. I said, "Claude, I'd like to invite you to visit our church." Claude replied, "No thanks. I already have enough problems." I think Claude's been to church. I think Claude's been involved in church. Paul knew that there's problems in church. And I wonder if his bad experiences in church could be because of a church or churches that were rooted in an unbiblical ecclesiology. Now, a church today can have a perfect biblical ecclesiology and still have problems, no doubt about it, because we're still sinful people. But I'm quite certain that if a church has an unbiblical ecclesiology, that church will experience more problems and worse problems than they would if they had a solid biblical ecclesiology. I believe Paul had Claude and people like him in mind when he wrote the foundation verse that I want to share with you today, and here it is again. And think about Claude as you think about what Paul wrote. "I write so that you may know how it is necessary to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth for people like Claude, who needs to know the truth and needs to see that truth supported and lifted up by the church that conducts himself in the way that God has, conducts itself in the way that God has designed." So we need to think, well, how has God designed the church? What is the conduct that God has given for the church to outline for the church to follow? This verse is 1 Timothy 3:15. It's interesting that Paul brings this up right in the middle of the epistle after he's already given three chapters in which he talks about ecclesiology, talks about church conduct in 1 Timothy 1 through 3. Zane, in his course, said he called this these three chapters the Pauline Church Manual. And I'm sure Zane would put in there mini manual. There's a lot more than just in what's in these verse in these chapters about ecclesiology, but this is a foundational manual. Zane felt mini manual on church practice. And I want to just give some highlights from each one of these chapters, just to give us a quick feel of what each chapter highlights about conduct in the church. Here's a line from chapter 1, "The goal of our instruction is love." In chapter 2, "Pray without anger and argument." Here he's talking about the church meeting together to pray, without anger and argument. Highlight in chapter 3 is, "An overseer, an elder, must be." Now, from those three highlights of chapter 1, 2, and 3, I want to summarize what each chapter is about in terms of direction for conduct in the church. All right, look at that first line, "The goal of our instruction is love." Now, I want to change it to a summary statement, "Live life together in love." God designed the church to live life together in love. All right, the second line, "Pray without anger and argument." What that's about in a summary is meet together in love. Don't have anger, don't have arguments. When you meet together in love. Okay, the third highlight, "An overseer must be." Here's a summary of what this chapter is talking about, is organization. Be organized together in love. God designed the church to be a pillar and support of the truth. Paul gives the foundation of what that looks like in the first three chapters. This is the essence of the first three chapters. Live life together in love, meet together in love, and be organized together in love. Now, we're going to look at more detail of what's in these three chapters, certainly not all of it, and we're going to also look today at what is taught elsewhere in the New Testament and some of what's taught in the New Testament, but all of it is to build upon these three points of ecclesiology. So let's go back to 1 Timothy 1 and get a little more wording of what Paul is saying. In verses 3 through 5, here are the highlights of verses 3 through 5, where he says to Timothy, "Remain in Ephesus that you may charge some that they teach no other doctrine than godly edification. The goal of the instruction is love." Now, we all know that church doctrine is certainly a foundation of a healthy church. You've got to have truthful, biblical doctrine. But notice Paul says in that last line, the goal of the doctrine, the goal of the instruction is love. Love in the church is the pillar and support of the truth. Doctrine lived out in love is the pillar and support of the truth. Without love, it's not much of a pillar or support of the truth, even if it has sound doctrine. Now, this is not original with Paul. It's original with Jesus. Jesus said in this famous passage to the disciples in the upper room, "By this all men will know that you're my disciples, by the love, if you have love for one another." The truth of salvation and discipleship, which is the foundation of why we exist as a free grace organization, we're committed to the truth of salvation and discipleship. But our truth of salvation and discipleship is not really the pillar and support of the truth without love. Jesus said, it's not by your doctrine, it's by your love that men will know the truth of the salvation and discipleship that you claim. And that truth, or that love, is to be expressed in the church. We see that developed through the disciples as they founded and led the church after Jesus left. And I want to give you three examples from the New Testament of what this love looks like in a church. There are many more, but here's just three. Encourage one another daily. Church is far more than coming and sitting and listening and singing for an hour on Sunday. Church is life together through the week. As he says, daily. Church is life together in love daily. It involves phone calls, texts, and visits toward one another to encourage one another. Here's another example, Galatians 5. Through love, serve one another. Church is much more than sitting for an hour a week listening and singing. It's serving, and that service takes place in life. This summer we had a man in our church that was critically injured in a motorcycle accident, and the men in his small group at the church kept his yard mowed all summer long, and it was a big yard. It was truly a labor of love. That's what the church is about, to live life together in love. That's the way God designed the church. One more example, forgiving one another. What is church? It's a group of people that forgives each other. Now, forgiving one another implies something obvious, but we shouldn't overlook it. If you're going to forgive one another, you have to have conflicts with one another. Church involves conflicts. If you don't have conflicts, you don't have church. Because church is about forgiving one another, and you can't forgive one another if you don't have conflicts with one another. And I'm only emphasizing that church is designed by God to live life together in love, including the conflicts that we have with one another, that we work them out in love and forgiveness. Without conflicts and forgiveness, we don't really have church, at least not the way God designed it to be. I want you to look at those three lines right there and think about Claude. If Claude had it in his mind that that's what church is, he would be saying, man, I've got problems. I need church to help me with my problems. Not, I've got enough problems. I need church. I need what's there. I need encouragement. I need help. I need forgiveness. And I think that Claude would have experienced the pillar and support of the truth of the gospel, where he might want to have listened to what the church, the message that the church should be and hopefully was proclaiming, and that is the saving message of Jesus. All right, here are the three points. Live life together in love, meet together in love, and I thought there was a third. I don't know what happened to the third. It got blotted out on that slide for some reason. Be organized together in love. Now, I want you to look at that top line, live life together in love. That's where the truth is ultimately lifted up. The pillar and support of the truth is ultimately lifted up in our dark world as the church lives life together in love. But behind living life together in love is meeting together in love. God designed the church to meet together in love for the purpose of helping each other to go out and live life together in love. The meeting is not an end in itself. It is a tool that is used, or a function that is used, to equip the church to live life together in love. And it's vitally, vitally important that a church meet together. This truth is seen repeatedly in the New Testament. Very quickly, here are three places. 1 Corinthians 11:18, when you come together in church. Acts 27, the disciples came together. Hebrews 10:25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. There's no question that God designed the church to meet together. Now, this truth became especially significant to me this year, and I'm sure it did to everybody in this room, because our church didn't meet for 3 months, March, April, and May. And, you know, we did church online, so to speak. You know, I recorded, and the music team recorded. We put it out online, encouraged people to watch. And what we discovered from that is a lot of people found this is a whole lot easier. This is a whole lot easier. Man, I can get up. I can stay in my pajamas. I can go out on the patio. I can go to church on my patio in my pajamas. This is cool. Sherry, my wife, has a friend. She plays tennis, and she had a tennis buddy this summer that said, I've been visiting lots of churches online. And Sherry lovingly said to her, well, that's not church. Church isn't something you watch. Church is a group of believers who meet together and get involved in each other's lives through the week. And you know, her friend took that very well, and she was glad that she did. Now, when we look at these passages about coming together as a church, we would think that if this is so important for church to meet together as a foundation for life together, that God would have designed the meeting of the church. He would have designed what he had in mind for when the church meets together. And he did give some direction for the design of the church meeting in the New Testament. And to get us thinking about that, I want you to look at the verse at the top. When you come together in church, 1 Corinthians 11:18, I want to give a little more context, just a very little more context to that. In the next slide, when you come together in church on ecclesia, the Lord's Supper, that's in verse 20. When Paul talks about coming together in the church using the term on ecclesia, he's matter-of-factly saying there in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 that you're coming together for the Lord's Supper. So for Paul, to come together on ecclesia is to come together for the Lord's Supper. He's using on ecclesia as a technical term for a meeting that refers to or includes the Lord's Supper. Zane had a comment about this when he said the New Testament bears no testimony to a multiplicity of regular meetings for the early church, but knows only one, that in which the Lord's Supper was observed. Now, notice in the third line of the quote there, Zane used the term regular meetings. I know in talking to Zane, and I see this also in the New Testament, that the door is open in the New Testament for other meetings other than the on-ecclesia meeting, the Lord's Supper meeting. But those other meetings, there's no direction or there's very little mentioned about other meetings, but there is one regular meeting that is prescribed and described in the New Testament. So we need to think, well, what did God prescribe and describe about this on ecclesia meeting, this Lord's Supper meeting? Well, one thing certainly, as Paul went on to say in 1 Corinthians 11:25, where Paul quoted Jesus, "Do this in remembrance of me," referring to the bread, which represents his body that was broken, the cup that represents his blood that was shed. And notice the word remembrance, amnesis. We get our word amnesia from that. On in front of it means no amnesia. I just kind of like, it was interesting to me to see that because it made me think about remembrance. You know, apparently God knows it's real easy for us to get amnesia about what Jesus did for us at the cross. And God, in his love and his compassion for us, wants us to be certain that we don't get amnesia when it comes to what Jesus did for us at the cross, that we continually bring to mind and remember what he did. And that's why he designed the on ecclesia meeting to be a reminder to us of what Jesus did for us at the cross. I want to go back to the 1 Corinthians 11:18 and 20 passage and add one more term. It's the word deipnon, the Lord's Supper. When you come together in church on ecclesia, Paul's referring to the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is the word deipnon. I'll never forget the word deipnon because the first time it was brought to my attention was when I asked Zane one time, "Zane, at your church, Victor Street Bible Chapel, when you have the Lord's Supper, you have a meal together. Why do you do that?" And Zane said to me, "What's a deipnon?" I don't know. Well, he told me, and then I confirmed it in my own study. The word deipnon is found 21 times in the New Testament, either in a noun or verb, the verb form. All 21 times, if you look it up, you can do that. It's interesting. You'll find that every time it's used, it consistently is translated dinner, banquet, feast, or supper. Dinner, banquet, feast, or supper. Dinner, banquet, feast, or supper. It's very evident that the word itself means dinner, banquet, feast, or supper. And it's no accident that when Jesus instituted the first Lord's Supper with his disciples in the upper room, they were at a table eating a meal together as he transitioned to the initiation of the Lord's Supper. Zane also pointed this out to me in 1 Corinthians 11:25, or I might not have noticed it. He took the cup after supper, after the deipnon, where I was conditioned to think, well, the Lord's Supper is made up of the bread and the cup. This verse says that the cup is not the supper, that the supper comes, or the cup comes after the supper, or to put it in a very simple order, the bread followed by the supper after the supper is the cup. But it's not any supper. The bread and the cup before and after the supper make it the Lord's Supper. It's the most special supper because of what the bread and cup make the supper to be. In the little book of Jude, we see the term love feasts, and that also reminds us that the Lord's Supper was designed by God as a supper or a feast. Charles Ryrie was aware of this. In the Ryrie Study Bible, Charles Ryrie says what other church historians, that, at least from what my reading, they seem to be unanimous on this observation, along with Charles Ryrie, when he said the early Christians held a love feast in connection with the Lord's Supper, during which they gathered for a fellowship meal. Ryrie uses the word fellowship. That's a good word to bring up here, because that's what a meal is. It's an expression of fellowship. It is in your home. It is when you're at GES. You go have lunch. Why would you want to go to lunch with somebody? Well, for fellowship. I mean, in every culture today and every culture down through history, a meal has been an expression of fellowship with one another, sitting together and eating together. And what do you do when you eat? You have a conversation. And this truth about conversation during the meal at the Lord's Supper is illustrated for us in Acts 20, verse 7, where we read that on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul spoke to them. But the word is dialego, and I'm sure you can see the English word dialogue out of that word. Paul didn't lecture to them. He dialogued with them. There was a conversation, a dialogue that took place, no doubt, a conversation about God's word. So dialogue is the pattern. I want to go back to the bread, supper, cup outline, but next to supper I want to put dialogue, because God designed that during the supper there be a dialogue concerning his word. 1 Corinthians 14, three chapters after the on ecclesia verse, Paul gives one of the guidelines for that dialogue in 1 Corinthians 14. He says, let your women keep silent in the churches, on tes ecclesias, for it's shameful for women to speak. That got cut off for some reason. In church, on ecclesia, you have the full thing in your notes. Now, what he's saying here is that women should be silent during this particular meeting. And he's not just talking about she shouldn't teach. He says she should be silent. In fact, I didn't put it in here. You can see it in 1 Corinthians 14. Even if she has a question, she's to wait till she gets home and not to even ask a question at this particular meeting. But I want to underscore, it's this meeting. It's only in the on ecclesia meeting that this instruction is given. This instruction to women is not given for meetings outside of the on ecclesia meeting. It's very clear that it's only in the on ecclesia meeting, which he defined in chapter 11 as the Lord's Supper. Now, Paul anticipated that there would be some that wouldn't be comfortable with this, that they would disagree or even ignore it. That's why he added, the things which I write to you are the commandments of the Lord. Paul said, this isn't me, this is the Lord. This is the Lord's commandment, and it's very important. Zane commented on this truth when he said, it's a false concept. The churches may follow or ignore this principle as they see fit. So, the outline is bread, supper, dialogue, cup. There's another element that is spoken of in Scripture, two more actually, in God's design. The next one is prayers that take place at the meeting of the church. Going back to the basic church manual in 1 Timothy, here's what Paul says in chapter 2. He says, I urge then, first of all, that petitions, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. He's saying that when the church meets, there should be a time for prayers, plural. Prayers for kings and those in authority, that we might have freedom of religion, to be able to continue to do what we do under the guise of the government. in this verse that you're looking at, he's saying we should be praying for the salvation of lost people. Lewis Berry Chafer wrote a book many years ago called True Evangelism, Winning Souls by Prayer. And certainly a pillar in support of the truth, wanting to get it out to reach people for Christ, certainly prayer for unsaved people would be a pillar in support of that effort to get the message of Jesus out into a lost world. Not only tells the church what to pray about, he tells the church who should do the praying as the church meets. He says in verse 8, I desire the men. And here he uses the word oner. Earlier he used the word anthropos. Oner means males to pray without anger and arguments. Somehow that got cut off of the slide. When you meet together in love. Pray together in love. Well, why does he single out the men to pray? What about the women? He says, I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. What he's saying is, at this particular meeting, the women are to be in silence, to not teach and to not pray out loud, because that's what the men should do. Now, I want to say very quickly that in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul referred to meetings outside of the Lord's Supper, outside of the on-ecclesia meeting, where a woman could pray out loud. It was just that she was to have her head covered when she prayed out loud. The point that I want to make here, that Paul's making 1 Timothy 2, is prayers. That in the meeting of the church, the outline is bread, supper with a dialogue, followed by the cup, prayers, and one other element in 1 Corinthians 14 when he says, I will sing with the spirit, I will sing with the mind also, referring in this context to the meeting of the church, there would be singing or song. This particular model is one that we followed for 45 years. It's been it is the greatest thing about our church. I hear this all the time from people that come to the Lord's Supper. It's my favorite thing about our church. We have Sunday morning meetings, we have small group meetings, we have children's meetings, youth meetings, but we have this meeting as well, and this is what I always hear. It's our favorite meeting for those that come. Thought you might want to see these pictures were taken last week. That's what the room looks like during COVID. There's a lot of spreading out. We used to bring pot. We usually bring a potluck. It's a potluck supper, but we do Subway boxes because of COVID. A little closer view, and then another during the time of prayer. We have a Sunday morning meeting where many more people come than who come to the Lord's Supper. I wish more came. We don't push people to come on Sunday morning. We let them know that the Lord's Supper is available. We encourage them, but we don't push them or make them feel guilty. It's available for those that choose to come. But one thing I want to tell you, I've never heard in 45 years. I haven't heard this one time. Why do we have it so often? Why do we do it every week? I've never heard anybody say that. Not one. In fact, if that ever came up, do you think we ought to have it every week? Do you think maybe we ought to have it like once a month or every other week? I guarantee you what I would hear. I would hear, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to have it less often when it's such a blessing when we do have it each week? On page 2, I've given you a little outline of what we put out on our bulletin each week with scriptures and songs. We have this on the front of the bulletin. At the bottom, I've given you a reference of a book that you might, if you're interested, my slide won't move. There it is. Pagan Christianity by Frank Viola and George Barna. Got a great chapter in there on the Lord's Supper. An article that you can find online, Why Are Our Communion Meals So Paltry? By Leslie Leyland Fields. God designed the church to be the pillar and support of the truth, to live life together, to meet together in love, to be organized together in love. And I knew I would probably not be able to finish, but that's why I gave you lots of pieces of paper. Let me briefly comment on the diagram about organization. You can. I've given you supporting verses for that on your sheet, so I'm not going to go through that, but I do want to make a couple of comments about it. Jesus is the head of the church. He is the shepherd, the pastor, the overseer. Under him are elders, plural. They're always plural in the New Testament. They are the ones that lead or rule the church. Nowhere in the New Testament do you find congregational rule. It's always the elders who give oversight and rule to the church. Nor do you find anywhere in the New Testament one man who is called the pastor. It's just not there. As a matter of fact, it's not there for three reasons. Jesus is called the pastor, the overseer. Never is one man called the pastor. Elders are always plural in the New Testament. And not only that, but there are multiple people with the gift of pastor-teacher. I'm on that chart. I'm up there in the upper left-hand corner. I'm one of the pastor. My gift is pastor-teacher. I'm one of the elders. But I am not the pastor. I am not the elder. And my wife is not the pastor's wife. And my children are not the pastor's kids. I am a pastor at Cypress Valley Bible Church, but I am not the pastor, and that's one of my strongest convictions in life. Zane said about this, we may confidently reject the idea that the scriptures know anything about a church headed by a single individual. All right. I think you can follow everything else in your notes. I think everything else is fairly self-explanatory. On this diagram, there it is again. At the bottom it says, all have a gift, all are saints, all are ministers, all are priests. I think most of you understand the theology behind all of those statements. I just want to mention one thing because there have been a number of comments about the role of women. The role of women, specifically, I think, is restricted when it comes to being an elder. The husband of one wife would preclude women being elders because a husband of one wife would mean that men would take the position of elders. Deacons, I've given you a paper there to show that a woman, in our mind, could be a deacon based on a number of reasons. That's in your handout. I want to talk just briefly about baptism. I gave you a reference on baptism in here. I think when Matthew records the Great Commission, Jesus is directing his instruction to disciples. It doesn't say to the 11 apostles or the 11 preachers. It just says disciples. He says, go and make disciples. So our view is that the Great Commission is disciples make disciples. Well, women are disciples, and women should be making disciples. And part of the disciple-making process is to baptize. So we feel that it's within what the Scriptures teach that women can and do baptize others. In fact, next Sunday we've got a grandmother. We have a young man that wanted to be baptized by his grandmother. And so we always interview the people that would baptize. And this grandmother is saved. She's been baptized, and she's growing as a disciple. And we're real excited about that. We've had a number of issues where that has, or times that that has occurred. Here's the bottom line of what I wanted to share today, going all the way to the end. God designed the church to be the pillar and support of the truth in three ways. To live life together in love, to meet together in love, and to be organized together in love. All right. Now, I'm reminding myself, Bob, you told me I had 3 extra minutes because we started 3 minutes late, so I finished right on time. Whew. Okay. And I think we're out of time for questions, isn't that correct?
Well, that's right. This isn't. This is not a meeting of the church, so the women can speak here, right? Should women be silent during the eating part or just during the teaching discussion?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. It's a unified discussion. It's not like there's a lot of discussions like there would be in many times when we're eating in a group. There's a discussion over here on this part of the room, and a discussion over here at this part of the table. It's a unified discussion. Paul dialogued with them. All the dialogue focused, you know, in and around Paul. So Paul would teach, they would ask questions. Same with Jesus in the upper room. Jesus taught, the disciples asked questions, made comments, but it was a unified discussion. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, so you're not there to just chat around
a
meal.
Yeah, and I'm glad that question came up. That would be a false vision of that if it was multiple discussions.
Okay. Do you feel that children, and there's that word again, let's say, do you think that children who may not yet believe should take of the bread and cup at the Lord's Supper?
No, the Lord's Supper is for believers. But we leave that decision in the hands of parents. If you feel your child has believed and understands what we're doing, they're welcome to stay. We have child care during the Lord's Supper for children that don't come. Of course, a lot of the children don't come because they're too young or not ready, but we have some children that come. It's real encouraging to see them there.
Should the number of elders be limited for practical reasons?
Okay. Number of elders should be limited for practical reasons, I think. Practical reasons. There's nothing in the Bible that says what number of elders there should be, except it should be plural. Never one. Always at least two. On the other hand, practical, you know, if you have more than a dozen elders, probably pretty hard to function very well. But there's a biblical reason that could limit the number of elders, and that is the qualifications. When it says the elder must be, guess what the little three-letter word is there? Dei. Must be. And I'm afraid that many churches have not followed through with that word. Well, he ought to be. Be nice if he was. Now, he must be. And I firmly believe that if an elder doesn't meet those qualifications, he should not be an elder, even if that means we have very few elders or none at all. We didn't have elders for a long time. We had an interim form of government because we refused to recognize men as elders if they didn't meet the qualifications. So maybe that helps to answer the question.
Bob, would that be then? I had a conversation with Zane one time. On that interim, is that a... Then would it just be as an interim, a congregational kind of church government then?
We did a semi-congregational type of thing, and then we had an interim, what we called an interim leadership board. Mm-hmm. And we developed our own qualifications, which was basically, is this a disciple? Does this man follow a life of discipleship, even if he didn't strictly meet the qualifications?
Okay.
Can you give us a synopsis on women and head coverings? Just a synopsis.
Yeah. It says when she prays or prophesies. It doesn't say when she teaches, just prays or prophesies. Those are heightened experiences with God, so to speak. Prophecy is the second gift under apostle, and there were women prophets in the New Testament. And if she prophesies, she needs to have her head covered as an expression of humility before God. And the companion is if she prays, which would mean if you prophesy, you do it out loud. When she prays out loud, she should have her head covered as well. And this would not be at the meeting of the church, because at the meeting of the church, she's not going to pray or prophesy. This is something that would take place outside of the ecclesia, on ecclesia meeting. That's a quick thing. By the way, people have said that's cultural. Well, if you read through that passage and you see that it's because of the angels. Angels aren't cultural.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's other reasons to support that.
Oh, this is a good question. So,
well, it might be good for you.
It's an online question. Bob and I have kind of discussed this. If the meeting of the church is only for believers, were unbelievers ever at the gatherings of the early church? Is there a place for unbelievers?
Well, there is a. It's in Corinthians that I think an unbeliever could show up, or somebody could be there that you thought he was a believer, but he's not. Yeah. So,
can they visit? Can they just watch, observe?
Well, when we have people come, we don't. Now, years ago, we used to interview them. We don't do that anymore. We just let them stay with us, experience it, and then, you know, we just try to talk to them as we would anybody that came on Sunday morning about who they are and what's going on in your life and that kind of thing. So,
we're running late on 3 minutes. Is that right? So we have three more minutes. Okay.
1 Corinthians 14:16 talks about the place of the uninformed.
Yeah.
And some people say that at the Lord's Supper you could have like a bench over on the side where the uninformed could sit. Do you think that's unbelievers or no?
I think it could include them, yeah. But I wouldn't put them on a bench over to the side. That doesn't sound very nice.
Well, little, we can make them wear that jacket that David Jansen has. Do you have to be old to be an elder?
That's good. I wanted to talk about it. It's in the notes. Timothy was 40 years old based on the calculations of people smarter than me. Hmm. And he is told, let no one despise your youth, and do not rebuke an older man, presbyteros. The older man is called a presbyteros, even though it's not a church office. He's older just because he's an older man. So if Timothy was 40 and called a young man in contrast to a presbyteros, then it seems that we have enough clues there to say that it's not wise for a church to have young elders, certainly not under 40. And I think some of you have maybe experienced the fallout of that. The age, or the term elder, implies maturity, and it's very important that an elder have some maturity. And in some cases, there's no substitute for age when it comes to maturity.
My wife can tell you, attest to that.
But I will say this, age is no guarantee for maturity either.
Mm-hmm. Your wife can attest to that.
My wife can attest to that. We had this discussion this morning.
Okay, last question. Can a man who has never married be an elder or a deacon?
Thank you for asking. The two of the most godly people I've ever known are Zane Hodges and Bob Sahlstrom. Now, Bob Sahlstrom was the head of alumni and church relations at Dallas Seminary when I was there. Godly man. Neither one of them felt they were qualified to be an elder. Zane had never been married. He would never be an elder. He would never allow himself to be recognized as an elder. No way. Neither would Bob Sahlstrom, because Bob Sahlstrom was a widower who remarried. Nothing wrong with that, certainly. Certainly. It's 1 Corinthians 7, certainly it's permitted and fine. But Bob felt, and I agree with Bob, and Zane agreed with Bob, that he wouldn't be able to serve as an elder if he remarried. Doesn't mean he couldn't serve and couldn't be used of God, but not as an elder.
That's our time. Thank you very much for that message.